No, all the people that I'm going to my
You ready to start? Is that okay? Set all the peanut butter behind us. And so I'm just going to talk, and anyone who wants to listen is certainly invited. Okay then? This time is of the essence. I only meet with you once a week for 4 weeks, and 1 week is already gone, so it doesn't give you much of an opportunity. The girls, as I said last time, I want to reiterate, I'm very new here, and I'm not familiar with the general customs here, so what I can just encourage you is to please stop me if I'm going too fast, and raise your questions, and I'll see if I can answer them. Today I want to speak to you about a few topics that come under a general heading called the Mesorah, which I wrote on the blackboard. We suggested last time we met, and I'm just going to reiterate it, that the development of Jewish law is a long process that begins at Har Sinai, and that's where Moshe Rabbeinu receives the Torah. He receives not just one, but two Torahs. One is the written Torah as we know it today, and the other is the oral Torah that's meant to be passed down orally from generation to generation. Last time we discussed a possible explanation as to why there had to be two Torahs and not one Torah. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that again, maybe not today, maybe next time. And this oral Torah is being passed on through what's called the Mesorah. The Mesorah is literally translated into English as the tradition. I would perhaps give it a different translation in this context. And the Mesorah is the transmission. Not the tradition, but the transmission. So we're going to save the word tradition for a different discussion, a different context, and that has to do with customs and traditions. But today we want to speak about the transmission. Now, is there anyone here in this classroom who might be able to answer the following question? If I want to know about the history of the Mesorah, the transmission, where would be the best place to look? There's some place in the literature, maybe we even have it here in the classroom, I don't know, this is not the main library, I understand, where I could look for a description in great detail of the transmission of the oral Torah. Anybody?
When Moses, like,
yeah. What did Moses do? I mean, Moses got the Torah. How did he transmit it? To whom did he transmit? How do I know the answers to these questions? Okay. And now I'm referring to a book which is called Avot, and this is a compilation of a Masechet, a part of the Mishnah. The Mishnah, as we said last time, is the beginning of the writing down of the oral law. Again, the ideal was that the oral law would be presented orally, and it would not be committed to writing, but the great Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the great king of Israel, Rabbi Yehuda, somewhere about the time of, let's say, 200 in this era, in the Common Era, he felt it was impossible. You know, the tradition and the transmission was faulty. You remember sometimes when you go to an electrical store, they tell you it's the problem is faulty transmission. So there was faulty transmission. The transmission was not succeeding. And as a result, there was a lot of complications and confusion about the Torah. So we needed, at some point, to take the oral law and commit it to writing, and that was in the form of the Mishnah. Okay, the Mishnah is the first form of the writing down of the oral transmission. Now, this period of time continues for, let's say, another century, two centuries. You know, we're now approaching, let's say, the year 400, coming close to the year 500. And at this point, we get to another major transition stage in the writing down, the committing to a code, a written code of the oral law. Does anybody know what that second stage is after the Mishnah? That's called the Talmud or the Gemara. Okay, so I'm just going to write that on the board to make sure we're all on the same page. The Gemara, okay? And this is otherwise known as the Talmud. Now, it's going to take quite a few centuries until the Talmud is a final, complete work. And it's made up of an intricacy of laws and discussions and dialogues. And this is what yeshivot are all about. You know, if you ask any good yeshiva bucko, what does he spend most of his day doing? And the answer is studying the Gemara, studying the Talmud. He is plummeting the depths of the Talmud. And what he's trying to do is he's trying to understand all those discussions which ultimately lead to, hopefully, a clarification and understanding and a deeper grasp of what the oral law is all about. Any questions so far? Okay, so we have the Mishnah, and now we have the Gemara. And the Gemara is translated as the Talmud. Okay, the word Gemara is in Aramaic, and Talmud is in Hebrew. But they mean the same. Okay, then? Now, the Gemara is organized in Bavel, which means Babylonia. So we're looking at about the year 500, and there are two great scholars who live at the end of this period of the Talmudic period, and their names are Ravina and Ravashi. And if you happen to have this compendium, this kind of a booklet, I guess you'd call it, you might want to look at a section here called the Oral Law, okay, which I think it's... well, I'll tell you the page as we go along in case you can't find it, if somebody knows already where it is. I don't know, I don't see a table of contents here, which sort of...
There isn't one?
There isn't one.
Oh, there isn't one. That's kind of confusing to me. In any event, you'll see this on page 65, and you'll see a long list of names on page 66, and at the bottom of that list is Ravina. Okay, so there's someone by the name of Ravina. This person by the name of Ravina, together with his colleague Rav Ashi, and again, right now, for my purposes, the names are not critical, but anyway, these are the two who are going to commit the Talmud, the Gemara, to writing, and that's going to take place and make a tremendous change in the entire history of the development of Halakha. What I would like to do in the next few minutes is try to illustrate to you how important of a change this made, the creation of the Talmud, of the Gemara. How important is that? How significant is that? Okay. Now, in order to do so, in order to sort of present this to you in a logical way, I want to talk to you about two great giants in Halacha who lived about 1,000 years ago. One, is it okay if I write on, you know, on the top of this board?
You can erase it. It's from this morning. It'll be erased.
So, okay, so I'm not messing up anything.
No,
one is called the Rambam, otherwise known in English as Maimonides. Everybody heard of Maimonides, right? He was the great genius who lived about 1,000 years ago. But someone that you may not have heard of, his first name was Menachem, but his last name was Meiri. Okay, now both of these giants lived more or less about the same time, 1,000 years ago. Now, the Rambam, Maimonides, wrote his greatest work, we could call it the magnum opus if you've ever heard that phrase, of the Rambam, is called by two different names, they mean the same thing, and it's called either the Yad, Y-A-D for Yad, or it's called the Mishnah Torah, which means like a duplication of the Mishnah. Of course, the Rambam writes in his introduction that he's going to take all the discussions of the Talmud, which are massive and intricate, and he's going to reduce all that to a very abridged, short, concise code And that's called the Yad or the Mishneh Torah. It's made up of Yad, Yud, Dalet, which is Yud is 10 and Dalet is 4. It's 14 books. And these are the 14 books that make up the Rambam. What I'm interested today in looking at for a moment is the introduction to this great work. And in the introduction to this great work, the Rambam goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu and he writes every single giant, every single scholar by name who received the Torah during an entire chain, an unbroken chain, that led from Moshe all the way to Ravina and Ravashi. If you remember, those are the names of the two great scholars who would codify the Talmud. And the Rambam counts 40 generations. There were 40 generations from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu until Ravina Rav Ashi, who would codify the Talmud. So it means the Rambam will tell you that Moshe passed on the Torah to Yoshua, and Yoshua passed on the Torah to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and so forth and so on. And he names each one, and he goes through 40 generations. Now that takes you more or less to the year 500. The Rambam lived in the year 1000. So there are 500 years which the Rambam doesn't give us, you know, the hand-to-hand transmission of the Torah. So the transmission of the Torah that is codified by the Rambam in his introduction to his magnum opus called the Yad compiles 40 generations that leads us up to the point in which the Talmud becomes a complete sealed work. The Meiri, on the other hand, in his commentary to Avot, at the very beginning, he goes even further than that. He actually fills in those 500 years that takes you up to the year 1000, and he tells you all the generations of the transmission from Ravina Rav Ashi at the end of the period of the Talmud, of the Gemara, all the way until him, until he himself. Now the question I want to ask you today is, if we focus our attention on the Rambam, why did the Rambam stop when he got to Ravina Rav Ashi? Why didn't he do exactly what the Meiri did and trace the transmission and detail all the names of those to whom the Torah was transmitted, from a Rebbe to a Talmud, to his student, from the student to his students, and so forth, all the way up to the year 1000. He just completely drops the ball, so to speak, if I can use that phrase, when he gets to the period of the Talmud. And that's where he stops, and that's where he terminates. Now, in order to try to answer that question, I want to ask a different question. If the Rambam is telling me historically who received the Torah from Moshe all the way down to Ravina Rav Ashi, does that make the Rambam a historian? Or perhaps, as an alternative possibility, the Rambam is a halachist. Meaning, what motivates the Rambam? Is the Rambam interested in giving us an insight into history? And I don't know if you girls are interested in history, but if you're interested in history, you have to learn a lot of names, a lot of dates, a lot of locations, you know, a lot of facts. You know, if you take a history course, you just got to memorize that. And when you get to the exam, you got to sort of spit back all that information. So the Rambam goes through 40 generations, traces every single one of the great giant scholars who are part of this transmission, and then he stops when he gets to Ravina Rav Ashi, around something like the year 500 of the Common Era. That's where he stops the ballgame. And can anybody give me their intuitive feeling? Don't be embarrassed. Is the Rambam a historian? No. I agree with you. Because if the Rambam was a historian, then he should have done what the Meiri did. He should have taken it all the way to the present date, which is 1000 in his time. Meaning, if I'm writing a history book, why would I stop prematurely and, you know, just all of a sudden, that's it, finito, the end, you know, I got to the year 500, I told you about Ravina Rav Ashi, they received the Torah from whoever they received it, that's it. No, the Rambam should have gone on and on and on, as the Meiri in fact did. The Meiri was a great historian. He would not leave out a single name up until his time period.
But the Rambam is not a historian. The Rambam is interested in halakha, and that's what the Rambam writes in his introduction, that the purpose of these 14 books that he's going to author, that make up the Yad, is to codify the Jewish law. We'll see a little bit later, if we have time today, about the Shulchan Aruch. He's going to codify the law to a large extent based on the Rambam, but 5 centuries later. So if the Rambam is interested in codifying the law, then I can at least justify the fact that the Rambam doesn't go beyond Ravina Ravashi, which means the time of the completion of the Talmud, of the Gemara. And he doesn't have to go beyond that. Question?
I think there might be any component of it which has to do with his personality, or like...
I'm not sure, because I would think if the Rambam really wants to give us all the names, it would not be in any way a violation of his humility. It would not upset his humility. I don't think it would be conceit or arrogance on his part if he would have given us all the names, you know, coming up to his period of time. Again, he wouldn't have to add his own name to the list, you know, that for sure. But, you know, I'm in the year 1000. Well, who received the Torah in the last generation? Every generation had someone who received the Torah. Now, girls, in order to understand this, and to try to figure out why the Rambam gives us those 40 generations and then he stops, what I call drops the ball, I'm going to ask another question. The Rambam tells me the following story. Listen carefully. This is the introduction of the Rambam to the Arach HaZok. He says, Moshe received the Torah at Har Sinai, passed it on to Yoshua. Yoshua passed this on to the Zakenim, that's the elders. And then he writes, after the Zakenim came in and Moshe Rabbeinu passed the Torah to them, then at that point he introduces the Torah and presents it to the entire Jewish community. So do you follow what's going on here? Moshe Rabbeinu is teaching the Torah and transmitting the Torah multiple times. On the first round, he teaches it to whom? Yehoshua. After Yehoshua, the Zakenim come in. They were men, that was a court that was made up of 71 elders. And after that, he invites all of the people of Israel and he teaches it publicly. So far, so good. You with me? And then the Rambam says, Vitziva Yehoshua Olav. And he commands Yehoshua concerning the Torah. The Rambam started with Yoshua. You know, Joshua was the first one to get called in. Then the Rambam continues and tells us about the elders, and then the Moshe Rabbeinu is passing on the Torah to all of Klal Yisrael, the entire community of Israel. And then the Rambam sort of reminds himself, wait a minute, I forgot to tell you something, that he commands Yoshua Olav on it. So first of all, what does that mean? He commands Yoshua. And secondly, why does the Rambam feel that after he tells me the whole seder, you know, the whole sequence of the transmission of the Torah, now he's got to tell me Vitziva Yoshua Olav, and he commanded Yoshua regarding the Torah. Does anybody want to take a stab at this? I mean, you know, if you could just kind of maybe steer me in a certain direction. Why does the Rambam mention these words at the end of his presentation? I'll read to you the exact language of the Rambam. The Rambam says, see if I can find it right now. I don't know if it's in the booklet here, but the Rambam says, Vitzivahu Alehem. Okay, he commanded him regarding Har. Har meaning the Torah itself. So he commands Yoshua regarding the Torah. This is after the Rambam already told me that Moshe Rabbeinu had transmitted the Torah time after time after time. Then, yeah, go ahead.
Just taking a stab, like, I think it's because at that point...
Who's he didn't want?
Joshua.
Oh, maybe Joshua didn't want, but Moshe Rabbeinu what? Commanded. Right. Correct? So in other words, what's going on here is that Yoshua has to play a very special role. On the one hand, Moshe is transmitting the Torah to everyone.
But at the same time, Moshe has to single out one individual for a specific responsibility for a mandate. And that's going to be Yoshua. Why? Why does Moshe Rabbeinu feel compelled, it's absolutely necessary, to single out one person? Is anybody following my reasoning over here? Again, if you think about the transmission... Yeah?
No, you keep talking.
Go ahead. I don't know your name. I know you speak a lot about peanut butter, but that's all I know.
And now we're eating it, because it's after lunch.
Oh, okay. Only after lunch. Otherwise, you won't be eating peanut butter for 2 months. This is... The name of the class, girls, is the transmission of peanut butter. Yeah, go ahead.
But to ensure the transmission of the Masorah.
Exactly. You need to ensure the transmission of the Torah. Go on.
Otherwise, it's like bystander effect.
Correct. There's got to be one individual. You know, we say in English, the buck stops here, you know. I guess in this case, it's Rabbi Shurin, I guess. The buck stops here, right? And somebody at the end of the day has to take responsibility for transmitting the entire corpus of the Torah to the next generation. And in each generation, there's going to be one individual who is going to be singled out as the transmitter of Torah, meaning that's where the buck stops. He will be absolutely responsible to make sure that that transmission is accurate, it's reliable. And by the way, I don't want to go off on a tangent, but even with regard to the written Torah, everything that we're talking about now is the oral Torah, but even with regard to the written Torah, there was a certain element of fear that somebody might tamper with the Torah. And Moshe Rabbeinu had 12 Sifrei Torah, 12 Torah scrolls written. Okay, why the number 12? Anybody know who got each one of those 12?
Tribes.
The tribes, like the 12 tribes. Each tribe has had its own Sefer Torah. And then Moshe Rabbeinu had a 13th Sefer Torah that was written. And what was the purpose of that 13th Sefer Torah, which he held on to?
He kept the Mishkan.
Correct, that if anyone would tamper with the Torah, and then we find some sort of discrepancy, the final decisor would be that one Sefer Torah. It's like, you know the story about the father and the son that are walking down the streets of London, and then they get to this big clock. It's called Big Ben. Anybody ever hear of it?
Yes.
It's this gigantic clock. So, just joking. So the son turns to his father and he says, "Dad, why did they put that clock so high up? I can hardly see it." "Ah," says the father, "if the clock was lower down, everyone would look at his watch and say, wait a minute, it's off by a minute." So everyone would tamper with the big band and change it a little bit to synchronize it with his watch. So there's got to be some final authority on the transmission of the Torah. Now, if I would tell you the following two premises, okay, premise number one is that in every generation of the history of Torah, of the oral Torah, there has to be one person who's finally responsible. You know, he's the chief advisor, the supervisor over the accurate transmission of the Torah. And if I were to tell you that from Moshe Rabbeinu until the time of the end, the closing of the Talmud, 40 generations passed, then can anybody here tell me how many names will appear on the Rambam's list? You remember our friend the Rambam, right? He's writing in his introduction the entire Masorah, the names of those who are in charge of the Masorah. How many names will appear on that list?
Should be 40.
40. That's exactly right. There are 40 names, because Moshe's name is going to be on top, Yoshua's name is going to be second, and then at the end of the list is going to be Ravina, who's in the 40th generation. He's the one who finally seals the Talmud. Now, my Rebbe, his name was Rav Soloveitchik. I don't know if you heard of him. His father's name was also Rav Soloveitchik. That's a funny coincidence. The difference is that his father's first name was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. His name was Rav Yosef Dov. So I'm going to tell you something that I heard from my father in the name of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. Now, just a little personal history here. My father, may he rest in peace, who's buried not far from here, was a student of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. I was a student of Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. My parents were married off by Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and I was married off, me and my wife, by Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Okay, so it's a, you know, we're heavy into the Soloveitchiks here, okay? Does anybody know what the word Soloveitchik means? Soloveitchik is a nightingale, which is considered to be one of the most beautiful, in terms of the singing of a bird, one of the most beautiful singing birds. Anybody know why this family might have taken on that name Soloveitchik? Even though I never heard my Rebbe sing, and I kind of doubt if he had a beautiful singing voice. But the Soloveitchiks are Levim. Levites, I think you say in English. Now, what were the Levim in charge of? They were singing in the Beit HaMikdash in the Holy Temple. Anyway, getting back to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, he says the following. A mind-boggling concept. This Mesorah is a reference to the substance of Torah, right, the contents of Torah, that's being transmitted. But add another word here, okay, and this word is called the Ba'alei HaMesorah, okay, and now we're not talking about the substance, the actual Torah that's being transmitted orally, we're now talking about the people who are part of this Mesorah. Meaning they are actively involved and responsible for the transmission of Torah. Now, what I'm going to try to impress upon you in the few minutes to come is that there's a certain halachic significance to being a membership, a card-carrying member of this exclusive group called the Ba'alei HaMesorah. Okay, so if you walk out of this classroom and you've memorized the phrase Ba'alei HaMesorah, then I succeeded in my goal for today, okay? So again, I'm going to ask for a choir here, but again, I'm not allowed to listen to women singing, but I can listen to women speaking, right? So if we could all say together in unison the following, I'll count to three, we're going to say Ba'alei HaMesorah together, okay? One, two, three.
Ba'alei HaMesorah.
Excellent. If you could remember that, as you walk out of this class, I will be the happiest guy around, okay? It'll be a great birthday party for my wife. A birthday present, I meant, for my wife. Okay, that didn't make any sense. But be that as it may, it's been a long day. Anyway, so there's something called the Ba'alei HaMesorah. Now, it's almost as if I would give you the following metaphor, so to speak. If, let's say, you wanted to be a member of a very exclusive club, and you got a membership card, you feel very proud of the status that you were elected to be part of this group, and you're a card-carrying member of this group. It's an exclusive group. So I can just tell you that anyone who has anything to do with halacha would give everything, his right arm, to be part of this group called the Ba'alei HaMesorah. Now, what is the significance of being part of the Ba'alei HaMesorah, which means you are part of the transition of the Torah? It means that you are part of that process of the transmission of the Torah, which will determine Jewish law. What does that mean? We know, and this is not something new to you, that the process of studying law, Jewish law, continues as we speak, to this day. We're still involved in debating, clarifying, and trying to determine how to codify the law. It's a process that still goes on today. And the Jewish people call the Amma Sefer, the people of the book, because I think statistically, even today, it's scientifically proven that we produce more literature than any other nation on the face of the earth. Because Jews like to talk. And if no one's listening, at least write it down. But I'm just kidding with you. But why do we produce so much literature? Because every day, every minute almost, another volume is written by someone who thinks he has an insight into the halacha. And that takes us all the way to Rabbi Manning, even. I mean, he's also producing pamphlets. I'm not going to tell you about all the books I published. That's because I didn't publish any, but anyway, but just theoretically.
You know what I'm saying? But what I'm saying is like this. What does it mean to be part of the Balei HaMesorah? So Rav Moshe Soloveitchik said the following. A mind-boggling idea. Why did the Rambam terminate his overview, his scheme of 40 generations? Why did he stop with Ravina and Ravashi in the year 500? And that's all. He doesn't go on. Says Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rambam is not a historian. The Rambam is a halachist. And the Rambam is interested in establishing who are members of this exclusive club and have the card that says Balei HaMesorah on it. I'm one of these Balei HaMesorah. That would be anyone within the 40 generations. But after the 40th generation, after Ravina Ravashi closed the Talmud, the Gemara, you're no longer in that group. And that has tremendous halachic implications. Says Rav Moshe, based on a source that he found in Masechta Bav Metzia, and we're not going to go into it right now because that's not so important to me. The Gemara says over there that Ravina and Ravashi, the last two in the 40 generations, are called, I'm going to write this in English, Sof. Anybody know what the word Sof means? The end of... Now this is a tough one, of Hora'ah. Okay? Now this word Hora'ah, I don't know if you can see it from all the way in the back, I would pick this up if I could, but I'm just afraid it might fall on me. Anyway, so...
You can erase if you want to.
It's alright. Hora'ah means literally teaching.
But the word Hora'ah, even though again, literally in Hebrew it means teaching, has a very specific... and powerful meaning in the world of halakha, of Jewish law. In fact, there are all sorts of issues about the following question. If, let's say, one rabbi issues what's called a hora'ah, who has the ability, who has the rights to question or disagree with that hora'ah? And there are many, many intricate laws. Now, according to this source that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik quotes, Ravina Ravashi, were the Sof Hora. What that means is that they are the last of the greats who can issue a final verdict, a decision in Jewish law that has the status of a Hora'ah. And what that means is that somebody who comes after Ravina Ravashi, let's call it generation number 41, in the Meiri's counting, right? Such a rabbi cannot argue with anything that came before him. Why? Because he doesn't have the power of issuing a hora'ah. Because what was the last period of time in which hora'ah could be issued? Only with Ravina Ravashi. They were considered, Ravashi was sof hora. He was the last of the greats who could have a hora'ah, and a hora'ah means he could issue a halakhic verdict that now is codified in what great work?
Where is that hora'ah? It's in the Talmud, it's in the Gemara. Now I come after the Gemara was sealed, okay, I'm in the 41st generation, and I want to argue with what came before me. I can't do so. Why? Because the hora'ah period ends with the sealing of the Talmud. And who sealed the Talmud as a closed book? And you can no longer add to it? That was Ravashi. He was the last. I think on that list he's listed last. Is he not? Let me just double check it again. Anybody remember what page I told you it was on?
I think it's 67.
67? Okay, on page 67. Let's just see if it's there. Maybe 66. Okay. Let's see what he has last on the list. Oh, he has Ravina here. I said Ravashi. Okay, Ravina. Apparently there were two Ravinas. There was one Ravina before Ravashi and one Ravina after Ravashi. So the later Ravina, Ravina the second, he was the last on the list. And at that point, the Talmud, or the Gemara as we call it in Aramaic, was completely sealed. Any final verdict in halacha, in Jewish law, that is in the Talmud, cannot be debated. It's undebatable. It's a final law.
it's almost, I don't know if I can give you an example, you know, certain countries have a constitution. Now, although there is a way in many legal systems of changing the constitution, but it's very hard, very difficult. And in that sense, the halachic constitution is the Talmud. And after the Talmud, we can have many, many debates, but we can never debate with that which is called Hora'ah, which is incorporated into the Talmud. And if that be the case, who is capable of a Hora'ah, of issuing a verdict which is unquestionable? Someone who has membership in the exclusive club called the Bali Amasora. And who has membership in this exclusive club? Anyone who participates in the transmission of the Torah from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu up to the time of Ravina, he's part of this group called the Bali Amasora. But beyond that, he's not part of the Bali Amasora. He can argue, he can debate, but he can't question any decision that came before him by the Bali Amasora. Yeah.
Why did they do that? Why did they seal the Talmud?
Why what?
Why did they? Why was the Talmud sealed? Like, why didn't they just
continue? I didn't hear the last word. Sealed?
Sealed.
Sealed. Oh, why was the Talmud sealed? Okay. The reason for that, which you'll see in his presentation, is that at some point in time, the generations became kind of thinned out, so to speak. They were spread. There was exile. There was persecution. And we didn't have the same kind of power and authority that we had back at the time of the Bali Amasora, back at the time of the writing and the compiling of the Gemara. So the Gemara now becomes a very, very critical text. And again, I come back to my original point that any good yeshiva student is spending his time, dedicating his time day and night to the study of Gemara. And hopefully those who haven't found the Basher yet will find such a young man who is dedicated to the study of Gemara. And Gemara is something something that has so much significance and so much status in the backbone or the development of Halakha that the Rambam wants to tell you exactly which are the 40 generations and how they passed on the Torah. And the oral tradition was preserved and then codified in the Talmud, and that creates something called a Hora'ah, and has that great status. Now, the Rambam, again, getting back to Maimonides, in his Yad, in the Laws of Tshuva, tells you that there's a group or shall we say three groups of people who forfeit their place in the world to come. In other words, their violation is so severe that they're out. And the first one on this group is a person who says that Torah was not given by God. He denies the divine origin of the Torah. The second one is HaKofer B'Torah Shebal Peh. He denies the oral law. And the third one, again, I'm just going to read it in the Hebrew very quickly and then try to explain it. Makhish Magideh. Very ambiguous terms. This is in the third chapter of Hilchos Tshuva. Now, Makhish is a verb. Magideh is a noun that describes a subject in plural. It's called Magideh. And these are the people, the Magideh, who transmit the Torah. Makrish means someone who contradicts them. So Rav Moshe Soloveitchik said that who loses his place in the world to come? Someone who tries to undermine one of the Bali Amasora. And he says about him that he's not an appropriate person, he calls him names, you know, he insults him, he says he's an idiot, he's stupid, he's immoral, and so forth and so on. Someone who says those words is questioning this whole process of the Bali HaMasor. Okay?
Can anyone think, and then I'll answer your question, can anyone think of someone who fits the bill of being machlish magideo? He is someone who tries to undermine one of the Balei HaMesorah and insults that person in the Torah itself. Okay? Wait. You try to keep it to yourself because I want to see how many girls can come up with the answer. I mean, I already heard the answer, somebody said. Yeah, you wanted to ask me a question, I'm sorry. No?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But wait, I forgot what it is.
Oh, okay.
Wait, where does it say these three things? Because this is after the time of the...
Well, the Rambam is in the third parak of Tshuva, of Hilchos Tshuva, the Laws of Repentance. Again, if I had time, I would go through the Rambam with you, and you know the commentaries on the Rambam will tell you what are the sources of the Rambam. I think, if I'm not mistaken...
Is this from the Rambam?
Yeah, what I just quoted is from the Rambam. Makrish Magideha is from the Rambam. The source for the Rambam is probably a Gemara in the Sechta Sanhedrin, which is one of the 63 volumes of the Talmud, okay? Okay, who do I have in mind, girls? Let's see by show of hands. Okay? Only three people? That's it? Four? Yeah, what do you say all together?
Korach,
exactly. This is the first rebellion against the Balei HaMesorah, and specifically against the greatest of the Balei HaMesorah, the first, namely who?
Moshe
Rabbeinu. And what does Korach say about Moshe Rabbeinu?
Why should you be the leader?
Correct. Kol Ha'eda Kulam Kadosh, the entire Jewish community are all holy. And who makes you any different? Why are you superior? And then look what he does. He gets together all of his people, you know, that are rebelling against Moshe Rabbeinu, and he stands in front of Moshe Rabbeinu publicly to try to undermine Moshe Rabbeinu's authority. So he says to him, you know, we're required to add to the tzitzis, don't look at me because I didn't do it, but we're technically required to add a blue string to the tzitzis. Anybody know what that's called?
Chalitz,
yeah. So here are my tzitzis. Okay, I think they're called in English fringes, although I don't like that word so much. But anyway, you add a blue string to the trelet. Okay, does anybody here amongst the men on the staff wear a trelet? I don't know. I don't think Rabbi Sherman
does. I don't think so. Wasn't it meant to be with natural dye?
Yeah, we don't know if we have the dye. It has to come from the chilazon, which is, we don't know what it is. Anyway, there's a whole debate. And here's one of the things where we really desperately need one of the Balei HaMesorah to tell us what exactly is this trailer. Anyway, so Korach is very dramatic. He gets together all his people and he dresses them up in garments that are made of trailer. Now again, as far as the law of tzitzit is concerned, the garment could be any color and any fabric, but you have to add one string on each of the four corners of tchelet. So he comes in front of Moshe and he says, do we have to add another string of tchelet on each of the four corners? I mean, after all, the garment itself is made of tchelet. Then he does another thing. He takes a building, a room, and he fills it up with all of the holy books. And then he says, do I have to put a mezuzah on the door? The mezuzah has one little section of all the holy books. This room is full of all the holy books. What was Korach's plan? What was he trying to do? He was trying to use common sense to undermine Moshe Rabbeinu's authority as one of the Balei HaMesorah. And he said, look, Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe Rabbeinu answered him, yes, you know, this garment that's made of total tchelos needs and requires a fringe of tchelos, and this room that's full of holy books requires a mezuzah. And Korach and his people start laughing at him. And that doesn't make any sense. It's counterintuitive. Because you tell me the whole room is full of what? It's full of holy books. Now I gotta add this little teeny mezuzah here? You tell me that the garment is made of tchelos, and now I have to add another string of tchelos? It doesn't make any sense. So what he was doing was, he was applying human, natural, common logic to the Torah, and he says, well, I'm going to interpret the law, because why do you have the right to interpret the law? And basically, he was what the Rambam would call makhish magideha. He was trying to undermine he who is in charge of the transmission of the Mesorah. Now, Korach was not one of the Balei HaMesorah. Korach was not someone who had the scholarship and the insight to interpret the Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu was the first of the Baalei HaMesorah. And therefore Korach lost his place in this world. Some say that he got a place in the world to come. Does anybody know what happened to Korach in this world? Do you remember the story? Yeah, he got swallowed up. You know, it was probably very hot in there. I don't know, probably you could choke yourself. I don't know what. But anyway, it seems like he didn't really survive it. I don't know. And some say that maybe on the way down he did his repentance and maybe... And so here was this clever pedagogue by the name of Korach. And it's so typical, because if we had time, I don't know, today, another time, I would like to show you that Korach reappears in every single generation. We've got plenty of them today. And this is the individual who tries to use his human logic and all his demagogy and try to undermine the authority of one of the Baalei HaMesorah and basically cast dispersion on the Torah itself. But the answer is that every garment needs a fringe of tchelet, and every single room needs a mezuzah. Because even though all of Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish community, is made up of great sanctified individuals, but one person has to take the role of guide, of leadership, of being absolutely in charge and responsible for the Mesorah, for the transmission of Torah. And that one individual is symbolically represented by the little humble mezuzah that you put on this room that's full of holy books, or by the one string of tchelet that you put on this garment that is full of tchelet. But we still need that one great guide, and that's going to be Moshe.
So, like, in the case of tzitzit, like, obviously that's incorrect. It's not, like, the way that they're supposed to be worn. So, like, how do you justify, A, wearing them, and B, how did that get lost in, like, since the time of the Baalei HaMesorah?
Right, so this is a very complicated question. I don't know if I have the time to answer it now. Maybe we should devote a whole class to this question. I'll tell you why. Because to identify tchelet, we need what's called a mesorah. And that Mesorah has to date back all the way to the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. And tragically, we've lost that Mesorah. Now, those who do wear tchelet claim that, you know what, if we don't have the Mesorah, we're going to study and investigate based on different sources in the Talmud and based on our understanding of science and nature and try to come up with what we believe is tchelet. The Mesorah is lost. At some point, the transmission, how did I say it before? Faulty transmission. We know what an esrog is. We know what tefillin look like. But we're not sure about tchelet. And somewhere along the line, it got broken. And at that point, we have to try to rack our brains, try to figure out what is tchelet. Go ahead.
So maybe I'm misunderstanding something, but the Mesorah is the actual...
Right.
So today, like when you still, you're saying people read all these books and they debate and whatnot. What are they debating them, right? Because they can't be actually debating the whole
thought. So again, let's just review one point and then we'll get to your question. Point number one is they are after the Talmud. They cannot create what we call a horah, which means that they could not hand down a verdict in any question that comes up, which is irreversible or not subject to debate. So that means that if I would have the right credentials, I can argue with anyone who comes after the Talmud, because that person, as great as he may be, doesn't have the capacity to create a horah, and if I can debate him. And then we have somebody who claims that, you know what, there are certain people that have been so accepted that we can't question their words. Now, I myself, personally, I don't buy into that. So, you know, Rabbi Shern asked me to teach this series, and it's a funny kind of thing, I'll tell you why. Not so funny, but you're probably not going to laugh, but what's funny about it, what's odd about it, is that this class, it's almost impossible to teach this class without a personal, individual perspective. So I told Rabbi Shern, look, you may want to fire me, I'm not on staff, but... I can only give my perspective. In my perspective, based on what I learned from my Rebbe,
there is no such thing as a hora today. And as great as it is, you know, we can still debate it. There's no one who can finalize this. Now, the first one who tried to create a code and have it universally accepted in an unquestionable, absolute way that no one could question it was Rav Yosef Cairo 5 centuries ago, who authored what? The Shulchan Aruch. But even that incurred the wrath of so many of his contemporaries. And in this little booklet, he has pages upon pages of those who were so, I don't know what word to use, they were ballistic against the Rav Yosef Cairo. And they said, how could this man have the audacity to tell me that he has the final decision on halacha? As if to say that he has the power of the Balei Mesorah to create a hora. And with all the respect, he doesn't. And they argued, what about all the scholars that came before him? Because Rav Yosef Cairo, when he authored the Shulchan Aruch, he goes back all the way to the time of the Rif and the Rambam. That's 5 centuries earlier. But there were 5 centuries of great giants. Including, again, I don't know if any of these names will mean anything to you, but the Trumas HaDeshet and the Maril and the Avudraham and others that go, the list is long and long. And Rav Yosef Cairo decides, you know what? I'm going back to the originals, the big boys, the Rambam. I'm going to skip 5 centuries and I'm going to give you the final decision, halacha. Who says that you can do such a thing? And I get really upset. But what can I say? And today, a Jew comes along and he questions the Shulchan Aruch? Oh boy, we got to put him in a special room called excommunication room or something along that line. But I never had it that way and I wasn't taught that. My Rebbe would quote the Mishnah Brura only when he had to disagree with the Mishnah Brura. Otherwise he wouldn't bother quoting it. Only when he thought the Mishnah Brura made a major blunder, that's when he would quote the Mishnah Brura. So I was 5 years in the Shia. And I never heard the Mishnah Brura. You go to... You know my joke about the Mishnah Brura? When I was in high school, we had a gym class. And after gym, we had an art class. So we had art with Mr. Getter. If Mr. Getter were alive today, he'd be about 150. Okay. So we used to come up from gym, we were a little bit disheveled, and we came into the art class. You know, Mr. Getter was Jewish by birth, that was about it. And he says to one of the guys, put those strings back into your pants. So the guy says, but the Mishnah Brura says, he says, I don't care what you do in Mr. Brewer's class. In my class, you put it back in. But in any event, there are certain, you know, there's certain codes that have become so well accepted that you can't question them. You know, if you question them and you have a different opinion, who knows? But you'll take a look, for example, in the responsa literature of Moshe Feinstein. You know, in America, for a long period of time, the most respected and revered decisor or posek, as we call it in halacha, was Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein never felt that he was absolutely committed to any book whatsoever, whether it be the Shulchan Aruch, whether it be the Ramah, whether it be the Taz, the Shach, or even the Mishnah Brura. So, for example, recently we had an issue about whether a woman who's getting married has to cover her hair. Have you ever heard about this? You know, at what point does a married woman have to cover her hair? So some say it's even before she goes into the chuppah. And some say it's after the chuppah. And some say it's after she comes out of the yichud room, you know, when she is together in privacy with her husband. And Rav Moshe says it's the next morning. So many cases in America, the minhag was, the custom was to follow Rav Moshe Feinstein, and a kala doesn't have to cover her hair. But somehow, that view of Rav Moshe Feinstein never made it here to the land of Israel. So here in the land of Israel, all the great decisors have decided to forget about Rav Moshe, or maybe they don't even know it exists. You know, this is a very hard tshuva, a very hard response to define. And therefore, it became an absolute requirement, and, you know, if you don't do this and the kala doesn't cover her hair, you know, who knows what? So what I'm... Well, I got off on a tangent here. All I wanted to say was, and I see we're really running out of time, although they cheated me of about 2 minutes. Because they were dealing with peanut butter and other issues. So they owe me 2 minutes. So if there's anyone here who wants to stay for another 2 minutes, I'll just end with this following point. What's unique about the transmission of Torah, and this is where Korach completely overstepped his bounds is that there's a concept called a teacher, a magid, or a Baal HaMesorah. And what really Korach was trying to undermine is that unique relationship between the teacher, the Rebbe, and the student, the Talmud. And that relationship, my friends, is so profound that it can't be described in words, because we think the Torah is made up of osios, of letters, but there's a lot more to the Torah than just letters. There's a whole feeling about what the Torah is all about, and that's what a Rebbe gives over to a student. What happened is that from the time of Ravina and Ravashi at the end of the Talmud and on, they started teaching Torah from the text. And that's when the Mesorah went all the way down. The Rambam says that for 40 generations, from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu up until Ravina, the Torah was passed down orally. In fact, even after Rebbe in the year 200 of the Common Era had codified the Mishnah, the transmission of the Torah was still oral. And the conversion from oral to written took place in about the year 500 after Ravina. And from that time on, it was all in the words of the book. And when it shifts to the words of the book, we miss the whole point of what transmission of Torah is all about. Because transmission of Torah is not about what it says in the book. It's about what we call the neshama, the soul of the Torah. And the words of the Torah are of the oral Torah are only a goof. It's only a physical, external body. But the real Torah is in the neshama. And the only way that a student could be part of the transmission of the Torah is through that personal contact with a Rebbe, through that interchange. When you see the Rebbe, when you learn from him, when you understand the neshama, the soul of the Torah, and that's called, which we'll get to next week in Yitz Hashem, Shimush. Okay, I'll just write it on the blackboard, and please remind me that if we have time, this is where I want to start with. Shimush means when you see exactly Torah in its life, in its reality, you watch the person, you see the way he treats other people, you see the way he interacts, you see the way he thinks, the way he responds to questions. This is not something that can be written on a piece of paper. This is the Mesorah of the Torah. The Mesorah of the Torah is the Mesorah of the Neshama, the spirit of the Torah, the Hashkafah of the Torah, the understanding and the philosophy of the Torah. That can only be transmitted orally, in a personal confrontation and a close, intimate relationship between a Rebbe and a Talmud, a teacher and his student. And that's why the Mesorah ended, because at that point, there was a shift and a radical transmission, thumbs down, in the transmission of the Torah. The transition was from the oral giving of the Torah over to the written of the Torah. Girls, have a wonderful week. And I hope to see you next Thursday if you're around. And again, you know, I still want to figure out how to encourage questions. It wasn't that successful today, but we'll get to it.
I literally want to give you a hug right now.
Yeah.
I'm like you, like, seriously, like, helped me, like, realize, like, what my, like, core issue is with, like, halakha and, like, learning Torah and, like sort of the, like, trusting in sort of, like, how it's been transmitted, like, since, like, I guess this era till now. And, like, so, like, how do we, so, like, are there, like, I don't know, I guess my question is, like, how do we, like, know, like, from, like, at the time when it's the end of the end of Mesorah, like, what, like, the halakhas are, like, what the, like, sort of, like,
we have to find a way of linking up with one person or more than one person who is part of this tradition. You know, the way the oral Torah was transmitted was through what we call a base medrash. You know, thank you. I think I mentioned this in a previous class. I'm not sure that in college, in university, I have something called a seminar.
Right.
And the thing about a seminar is that a bunch of people get together you know, they're all well read and well versed, and then they debate it and they discuss it. That's what a Beis Medrash is all about. If you have sensitive ears, you don't want to walk into a Beis Medrash because the volume is so loud as people are yelling at each other and screaming at each other. I'll never forget, I was once involved in a debate in the Beis Medrash with Rabbi Yochanan Zweig, one of the great geniuses of that generation, and all of a sudden, there was quiet in the Beis Medrash. 150 people turned quiet and listening to me, this little guy, debating with Rabbi Yochanan Zweig. But that's what a Beis Medrash is all about. You know, we throw shtenders at each other, we get really excited. And that's how we clarify things, and that's the personal relationship. So what we need to do today in order to link up to this transmission of the Torah to Torah Shebaal Peh, we have to find ourselves in a school where we can get close, and I don't mean close in a physical or emotional sense, but maybe that too, but to the neshama of the Torah. Who can be that person for you and for me who can represent and teach me the neshama of the Torah?
Wow.
But forget about all the written books. The written books become secondary. You know what I'm saying? We get so caught up with the book.
I know, and we even in the school, we look at the sources, and we we're learning the halachas based on those sources, but those sources aren't necessarily
So look, those are good skills and very important skills, but if you ask me, I don't know if they have here in Midrash Rachel, I was in charge of a yeshiva that's called Mevaseret, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, and there we used to have a question and answer period. We used to get more out of the question and answer periods than we got out of breaking our heads over the text. Or for example, a personal discussion. You have a Rebbe, you go in, you discuss something with him, and you see the way the man thinks, the way he relates to issues, the way he embraces life. That's even more important than the text. That's the neshama of the Torah. So we were sitting there with Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know, we're 100 guys, and we were absolutely dumbfounded by his intellectual genius, the power of his logic and his knowledge. It was just mind-boggling. But that, at the end of the day, was just the osios of the Torah. And it was so few of us that we're able to get close to him outside of the framework of the classroom, not in a formal sense, but where we could get to see, and mostly the people who did that were living in Boston, you know, where the Rav lived, and that's where they got to see a different life. You know, when he took off his tie and his hat, and you watched the way he lived. That's what we're going to discuss, God willing, next week, called Shibush. Okay, so remind me to speak about Shibush. Okay, then? All right, let me get out of here because I think they need the classroom, and I'm